Alrighty, so I'm going to re-record this lecture because I think it had like some parts where we're going in and out. So let's just go ahead and get started. So the content is coming from chapter 63 and 64, and these are the conditions we're going to be going over. So our first condition is multiple sclerosis, which is also called MS. So this is a chronic progressive degenerative disorder of the central nervous system. And so a little bit about its patho is that your normal neuron cells, nerve cells, has myelin sheaths that cover the axons that kind of protect the communication that's going from the dendrites in the upper part of the neuron to the end. So with this condition, the myelin sheaths are continuously destroyed, which affects the communication that are sent between those neuronal cells. So with MS, there are three pathologic processes that characterize it. So the first process is going to be chronic inflammation. And so the second process is where the myelin sheaths will start demyelinating. And as you can see, as they're damaged, they're starting to peel back and expose the axon, which is pretty much responsible for getting that message through to another cell. And so as the inflammation continues, those myelins lose the ability to regenerate. So, it effectively at in the end, there's going to be scarring from the damage as a result of this condition. So the next slide here just pretty much just kind of shows you what one of those demyelination plaques will look like, what it looks like in someone that had chronic MS. And so P on there shows you that plaque, and then the V is just showing you a remyelinated shadow plaque. So the other picture next to it just kind of shows you the manifestations that someone will develop with the MS condition, and which we'll talk about more on the next slide. So usually the first symptoms that someone with MS experiences is they'll have blurred or double vision, and they also have a red-green color distortion in their eyes. So if you ever go to the eye doctor and they ask you to look at that picture in the book, and it has like a red-green kind of they want to see if you can see the red and the green in the image. And so with someone that has MS, they can't determine the difference between the two colors. So they can also be blind in one eye as well. So common manifestations with someone with MS, because again, the patho is where that myelin sheath is destroyed, so the communication is impaired between those neuronal cells. They have motor problems, sensory problems, cerebellar problems, and emotional problems as well. So from a motor standpoint, the muscles are going to be chronically affected. These patients describe muscle weakness in their extremities, and especially with coordination and balance. So these symptoms can affect walking or standing for them. So they can't like walk long distances or stand for too long. It can end up leading to paralysis in worst case scenarios. But one of the key signs that they experience as a sensory manifestation is Lermet sign. And this is just a sensation where they have an electrical shock going down their spine into the limbs if they flex their neck too much. So MS has different patterns that it can be presented in patients. So the first one is relapse and remitting, and this is clearly defined as attacks of worsening neurologic function. So they have this, the relapse part. And then they have partial or complete recovery, which is the remission part. And so usually majority of MS patients are diagnosed with the relapse and remitting pattern of this condition. So the next one is your primary progressive. And this one, they'll have steadily worsening neurologic function from the beginning with minor improvements, but no distinct relapses or remissions. The secondary progressive, this one they'll have a relapse and remitting initial course followed by progression with or without occasional relapses, minor remissions, and plateaus. And then your last one, which is progressive relapsing, is this is where they're going to have progressive disease from onset with clear acute relapses and with or without full recovery. So there'll be periods between the relapses characterized by continual progression of the MS condition. So this one is less likely in most MS patients. So they see about 5% with progressive relapsing. So there is no definitive diagnostic test for MS. They kind of just go off of the manifestation. And if they do an MRI, you can see those demyelinated plaques in the brain. So they can test the CSF fluid on them to see if immunoglobulin G is present and if they have oligoclonal banding present. So usually they just have to, to confirm a diagnosis, they have to have at least two lesions in two different locations in the brain, in the central nervous system, and experience in the manifestations to get a distinct diagnosis. There is no cure for MS, it's more so trying, the goal is to try to slow the progression of it. So the different medication and treatment options that we have are going to be immunomodulators. These kind of modify the disease progression and help them from going into relapsing episodes. So these are going to be injections. So we have to do patient education on performing self-injection techniques. We have to teach them to wear sunscreen and protective clothing whenever they're exposed to the sun. And they have to report any side effects. And if they experience any flu-like symptoms, we tell them to treat it with NSAIDs or acetaminophen. Corticosteroids are mainly used whenever they go into those exacerbation episodes, and this just kind of helps with reducing the edema and the acute inflammation at the site of the demyelination. So, of course, with our steroids, we want to make sure that we're educating them as well, that they can't abruptly stop them. And make sure that they know drug interactions between steroids and any other medicines that they're on. The next treatment is your plasma exchange or your IV immunoglobulin. So these are usually used for short periods of time whenever steroids can't help with symptom improvement. So they can do the plasma exchange and the IV/IG treatments. I had a friend that had MS, and she goes once a year for one of those plasma exchanges and the IV immunoglobulin treatments. Exercise is something else that we want to kind of talk about with them. It helps to increase their coordination since they have issues with it, and it helps retrain the muscles that are not affected by MS in instances for them. So as far as nursing implementations, there are, with MS, there are triggers that can cause them to go into those relapsing episodes. So for my friend, her relapsing episodes was every time she would get pregnant. So every time she would get pregnant, she would have a relapsing episode and where she would start experiencing those extreme symptoms where she's extremely weak and she couldn't barely do anything. But when it's caused by those triggers, we want to educate them on refraining from doing those things that can cause them to experience it. So avoiding anything that's fatiguing, extremes of hot and cold, if they're exposed to any infections, Those are all things that can cause them to relapse. We also want to tell them to maintain a good balance between exercise and rest. That's going to be very important. They need to minimize their caffeine intake and make sure that they're taking in a nutritious, well-balanced meal. So those are all going to be very important things to kind of educate them on. So our next condition is going to be Parkinson's, which is also called PD. This is a progressive neurodegenerative disorder that's characterized by three distinct types of movements that these patients will experience. So bradykinesia, rigidity, tremors, and they'll have gait changes. So men, of course, are more likely to develop Parkinson's than women. And the exact cause of it is really unknown. So the patho of someone with Parkinson's is that they have a lack of dopamine, ultimately. So with them having those, they're going to have degeneration of dopamine-producing neurons in the substantia nigra of the midbrain. So those cells that produce dopamine are going to be decreased due to those neurons being destroyed. These patients also have what's called Lewy bodies in their brain, and these are unusual clumps of protein that are there. So that patients that end up having like an autopsy to kind of see what happened, if they look in their brain, they will notice that they have Lewy bodies. So Lewy bodies are present for someone with Parkinson's. So we're going to talk about the key manifestations of someone with Parkinson's in a good way to kind of remember it is by remembering TRAP. So the T stands for tremor. So this is usually the first sign of someone with Parkinson's where they develop that tremor. And the tremor, of course, is going to affect their handwriting. It's aggravated by emotional stress. And they categorize, they describe the tremor as like a pill rolling. Like they're rolling pills between their hands is how they describe their tremor. So the R stands for rigidity, and this is just due to that stiffness that they're going to have in their upper extremity. So it's increased resistance to passive motion whenever those limbs are moved. So their rigidity is described as cogwheel rigidity. So it's like a jerk-like quality. Whenever they try to move, instead of it being a smooth movement, it's more jerky like whenever they're moving those extremities. The A stands for akinesia, and this is just where they have absence or loss control of those voluntary muscle movements. So muscles that they can voluntarily move, they no longer have the ability to. The P stands for posture and balance, so they're going to have a posture instability where they have loss of those automatic movements that will occur subconsciously and so on. So these patients have like a stoop posture, a mask face, and they have like that shuffling gait that they'll experience. So these are some complications that can arise from someone having Parkinson's, of course, with the motor symptoms affecting their mobility. They're going to be weak, and so that weakness can kind of start spreading to their swallowing. So swallowing is going to become more difficult for them. They can experience malnutrition or even aspiration risk, they can lead to end up having pneumonia. They can have UTIs and skin breakdown. Orthostatic hypotension is something that's also common in them. And with them having a loss of those postural reflexes, it can cause them to fall and develop any other injuries. So there aren't any specific tests to kind of help with diagnosing PD. They pretty much go off of a good history and physical on the patient. seeing if they have the manifestations present, and usually if they have it on one side, having those symptoms, that's usually how they can kind of confirm, along with giving them the anti-Parkinson medications. And if they have a positive response to those medications, then of course that'll be an indication that Parkinson's is the issue. So the ultimate goal with maintaining Parkinson's is going to be to kind of correct the imbalance with the neurotransmitters in the central nervous system. So we start them off with anti-Parkinsonian drugs. And so these will either enhance or release the supply of dopamine, or it'll block the effects of overactive cholinergic neurons in the brain. So that will be for the cholinergic. So we use those two choice of drugs for it. So our most common treatment is going to be the levodopa with carbidopa, which is also called Cenemate. This is our primary treatment. So when we give this, we want to educate them on monitor for signs of dyskinesia. So that is a side effect of Cenemate. We also want to educate and tell them not to take levodopa with any food, because protein reduces the absorption of this medication. Usually with Parkinson's, we only prefer them to be on one drug so they can have fewer side effects. Another treatment option that they can do surgically for someone with Parkinson's is deep brain stimulation, and that is just where they'll kind of go in and it decreases the increased neuronal activity that's produced by the them not having enough dopamine. And so almost kind of similar to like how a pacemaker works for the heart, but this is a like a pacemaker for the brain. They'll go in and put the electrodes in the brain and then attach it to a neurostimulator in the chest, like a pacemaker. Ablation, where they'll go in the brain and destroy the area that's affected by Parkinson's, or they can do a transplant so they can use fetal neural tissue and the basal ganglia to kind of help produce the dopamine that's needed. So as far as dietary changes with patients with PD, because the dysphagia and bradykinesia are going to be present, we want them to kind of eat more appetizing foods that are easier to chew and swallow. So we also prefer them do six smaller meals versus three larger meals, because they're going to need more time to chew and swallow. So it's less tiring when we do more meals versus those three larger meals. So some more on education and teaching with these patients. We definitely want to promote independence with them. So removing any rugs and excess furniture, helping with simplifying clothing for them. So like for example, giving them like maybe like a zipper clothing instead of buttons. Buttons can be something that's harder for them to utilize. So we also want to recommend them using like an elevated toilet seat, and we can also tell them to use an ottoman to kind of help elevate their legs. Safety alerts for someone with Parkinson's. We can kind of tell them some different ways to prevent falls from occurring. So we want them to consciously think about stepping over an imaginary object on the floor. This is a way to kind of help them focus. We can also tell them rock from side to side before stepping forward, and that kind of helps them to maintain stability before stepping. Walk to a beat of music. So if they think about a rhythm in their head, that can kind of help them kind of maintain a balance. We can also recommend swinging both arms from front to back, or taking one step backward and two step forward. So those are some options that we can kind of give them to prevent them from falling. Our next condition is myasthenia gravis, which is also called MG. This is an autoimmune disease of the neuromuscular junction, and so it's categorized by them having weakness in certain skeletal muscles. So on a patho level, this condition is caused by autoimmune response. So the antibodies are attacking the acetylcholine receptors, and this is resulting in lesser acetylcholine receptor sites at the junction area. So manifestations with MG is going to affect multiple muscle groups, which include muscles used to move the eyes, the eyelids, chewing, swallowing, speaking, and breathing. So those are all the main muscles that are affected by this condition. So the muscles of the trunk and limbs are going to be sometimes affected. The proximal muscles of the neck can be affected more often than the shoulders and hips are. So anything distal is more so the ones that are proximal that are affected the most. Something that we see in these patients, their muscles are going to be their strongest in the morning upon awakening. So usually by the end of the day, they're completely exhausted because of the continued muscle weakness. So periods of rest are going to be important in them to help them kind of restore their strength. A complication of having myasthenia gravis is a myasthenic crisis. So different things that can lead to them going into this crisis are fatigue, pregnancy, illness, trauma, temperature extremes, stress, and hypokalemia. So these are all examples that can lead to them experiencing this crisis. And so there are other medications as well that can lead to this, which include beta blockers, quinidine, phenytoin, certain anesthetics, and aminoglycosides. Antibiotics can worsen myasthenia gravis and lead to this crisis. So there are different diagnostic tests that can be used to diagnose MG. The main thing is that we're going to be looking for muscle weakness. So a test that we can do is a fatiguability test, where we have them look upward with their eyes for 2 to 3 minutes, and if they become fatigued within that time frame, of course, that's a positive indication for this condition. Drug therapy, uh-oh. Drug therapy for them, we choose anticholinesterase agents, steroids, the same way we would with someone with MS, and we do immunosuppressive agents as well. So these patients that can have their thymus removed to kind of help with this condition, and we can also do the plasmapheresis and IV immunoglobulin treatment. If they are going to be on anticholinesterase medications, we need to make sure that they are able to distinguish between a cholinergic crisis and a myasthenic crisis. So with the cholinergic crisis, they're going to have involuntary muscle contractions, sweating, excessive salivation, and constricted pupils. Some things that is going to be important is making sure that they choose foods that are easier to eat and swallow, because again, those muscles are mainly affected by this condition, and they need to plan their ADLs according to their body starting to have that weakness period. So usually if they're going to be doing a lot of things in a day-to-day period, they need to do it earlier in the day when their muscle strength is at its strongest. We also want them to aim at scheduling their dose of medication where it's at its peak during mealtime so that they can be able to eat all of their food. Our next condition is ALS, which is amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. And this one is a progressive neuromuscular disorder marked by loss of motor neurons. So pretty much those motor neurons are dying. And so with them continuously dying, of course, muscles aren't going to be able to get that communication to contract. And then the muscles are going to become weak and start to atrophy and die. So typically we commonly see this happen more so in men than women as well. The guy that plays Mark Sloan in Grey's Anatomy, he was just recently diagnosed with ALS. And so it's a terminal condition because eventually these patients end up dying from losing their ability to breathe. And so on a patho level, the dead motor neurons, of course, can't produce or transmit signals to those muscles. And so usually they'll start having motor skill issues at first. They'll notice they start tripping over things, dropping things, or stumbling more often. So there are two onsets for ALS. So limb onset, and this is just where the arms and legs are going to be affected. And then bulbar is where they start to have issues with speech and swallowing. There is no cure for ALS, which is why, you know, it's very sad whenever someone is diagnosed with this. But we do have medications that can slow the progression of it. So Riluzole is the medication that can. And Endarvone, this medication is given IV daily for 14 days, and then they go another 14 days drug-free from having any medications. So as far as intervention-wise for these patients, facilitating communication because they are going to eventually lose their ability to speak. So coming up with ways to kind of help them get creative with communicating. Reduce the aspiration risk because, again, they're going to lose all ability. So once they start showing signs of aspirating, it's going to be important to kind of take note of. Early identification of respiratory insufficiency. So being aware of those first signs of respiratory distress in them. So our next condition is Huntington's disease. And this condition is a progressive degenerative brain disorder, and it also has a poor prognosis because once they progress into full-blown Huntington's, they have a decreased lifespan. So Huntington's is genetically transmitted, of course. So if an offspring of a person that has HD, they're going to have a 50% risk for inheriting it as well. So and it's likely seen more, we usually see this in men. Chicago Med had an episode where there was a father, he was diagnosed with Huntington's and he didn't have family. No one was really talking to him and he didn't talk to his son. And he practically tried to kill himself because he was tired of living with Huntington's and he didn't want them to tell his son about his condition either. But on a patho level with this one, it's opposite of someone with Parkinson's. So this one, they have too much dopamine being produced. So dopamine is primarily used for like coordinated movement. So with them having too much dopamine, these patients have uncoordinated, involuntary, abnormal, and excessive movements, which is called chorea. So usually their arms and legs are always twisting and moving around without them having control of it. My first day as an advanced care tech at Forest General, I end up seeing a patient have this on AT. And so his movements, they were just so erratic and like he had no control over it. And so that's usually how they present with this. because of the increase in the facial movements, it'll affect their speech, chewing and swallowing, and then they'll be at risk for aspiration and malnutrition as well. Their gait is going to deteriorate, so that you lose the ability to walk and it becomes impossible. And of course, and eventually they can't talk or eat anything. Because of how fast it progresses, these patients, they will start experiencing depression and anxiety and agitation. And so they withdraw themselves. And so that episode kind of showed how he kind of withdrew himself from society. He really didn't want to deal with anyone. So yeah. There is no cure treatment. It's usually towards palliative care. They can do kind of some symptomatic treatment and give tetrabenazine to kind of help with the chorea, but these patients are going to have to end up being on psych meds to kind of help with the anxiety and depression and everything, so SSRIs. Because the chorea causes them to lose a lot of calories, we want to increase calorie intake in them to at least 4,000 to 5,000 a day. End of life issues. So they have to have those very uncomfortable conversations early because they need to know, okay, we're in the instance where you lose ability to care for yourself or talk or make decisions. Like, what do you want? You know, how do you want to proceed? So this is one of those conditions where this conversation is had early. All right, so our next condition is going to be Alzheimer's disease, and this one came from chapter 64. So the ultimate Gray's Anatomy, Meredith Grey disease is what I'm going to call it. So pretty much we have a chronic progressive neurodegenerative brain disease as well. And so they're going to have changes in their brain structure and function. So we're going to talk specifically about it. So the patho of Alzheimer's is going to be characterized by a few different things. So they have plaques present in their brain as well. And so these plaques are clusters of insoluble deposits of beta amyloid, other proteins, remnants of neurons, non-nerve cells like microglia, and other cells such as astrocytes. So these plaques kind of are present, and that's how they can kind of detect someone with AD. Beta amyloid is something that's overproduced in them, and so this is and it's associated with the cell membranes. These patients also have neurofibrillary tangles, and the main component of those tangles are going to be tau protein. And so they're also more abundant in the brains of someone that has Alzheimer's. So this next slide shows you the picture let me use my little, see if I can do the little laser. So this right here is what a normal brain should look like, and this is what the brain of someone with Alzheimer's looks like. So as you can see, it's shrinking, and it's very different from the other side. Everything is a little bit more deeper on this side. So this is normal. This is someone with Alzheimer's. So as far as manifestations in someone with Alzheimer's, so the symptoms don't always correlate with the abnormal changes within the brain. And so it's categorized based off of different stages. So mild, moderate, and severe. So for progression of Alzheimer's, it goes from mild to severe. And so initially, they'll present with changes in their cognitive function. And so family members will notice that they're having a change than someone else on the outside. And so they'll report those to their healthcare provider. And so it usually appears as memory loss or mild disorientation or trouble with their words and numbers. As the disease progresses, their personal hygiene, of course, is going to decrease. They'll have a decline in concentrating attention. Their behavior is unpredictable, so they don't know what they'll do, and they'll start having delusions and hallucinations. So retrogenesis, this is something that Alzheimer's patients will experience, and this is a process where degenerative changes are going to mirror in a reverse order. So what that pretty much means is the patient is going to start presenting with symptoms, and they're going to be a lot, not symptoms, as far as how they will act as a child. So even if they are, say for instance, 72, at 72, they will mimic the age of a younger child. So maybe like a 5 or 6 year old, they'll start experiencing behavior. So that's the retrogenesis part of someone experiencing Alzheimer's. All right, so the criteria for someone where they kind of diagnose what stage of Alzheimer's they're in. So there are different things that they're going to go off. Of course, they'll look at imaging and biomarkers, but there is a spectrum of Alzheimer's disease and is characterized by 3 levels. So preclinical Alzheimer's, this is a long lag time between brain changes and when they start showing signs of Alzheimer's. So the goal of this level is to modify it before the plaques and tangles form, before the symptoms start emerging in attempts. Current attempts have not been successful during this phase to kind of reverse it, but research is still ongoing to kind of help with maintaining it at an early stage. So mild cognitive, this is the second stage, and the patient is having issues with memory, language, and other essential cognitive functions. So it's noticeable to the family during this period. Amnestic is where they forget important information that would have been easily recalled, but they're aware of their change in the memory. Non-amnestic is where it affects their ability to make sound decisions or complete a complex task. So the last stages of the spectrum is dementia, and this is the terminal phase, and they usually don't have a good prognosis after they hit that spectrum. So there are also other different studies that they can do for someone to detect Alzheimer's for the neuropsychologic testing. So the mini-cog test, this is where they have them draw a clock, and this is to assist their cognitive function. So another test is the MMSE, which is the mini mental state examination. And this is going to assess their orientation, recalling, attention, calculation, language manipulation, and constructional practices. The last one is the Montreal Cognitive Assessment, which is also called the MoCA. And this one assesses memory, language, attention, visual, spatial, and executive functions. So, of course, they're going to do the CT and MRI to kind of see the brain atrophying, of course, and the PET scan can kind of help distinguish Alzheimer's from other types of dementia. So, those are our different ways that they can do it. But usually, they don't get a definitive diagnosis until that person passes away and they do an autopsy of the brain. Medication-wise for Alzheimer's, so for their decreased memory and cognition, we can do cholinesterase inhibitors or N-methyl D-aspartate receptor agonist medications. So an example of the cholinesterase are going to be donepezil, galantamine, And the NMDA is memantine. That's a medication, memantine. For the depression, of course, we can do the SSRIs or any other atypical antidepressants. For behavior problems, doing antipsychotics or benzos. And they're going to have issues with sleeping, so our choice is zolpidem for sleep disturbances. Nursing management, these patients, we need to know how to be able to manage them whenever they come in. So they're going to have behavior problems, of course, where they experience repetitiveness, delusions, hallucinations. They're going to be agitated. They're going to be aggressive sometimes. They may have altered sleep patterns. They start wandering and resisting care. So something that we commonly see is sundowning. And this is where the patient becomes more confused and agitated in the late afternoon or the evening. So some different interventions we can do to kind of help with those behavior problems are remaining calm and avoiding confrontation with them. That's going to be very important. Making sure that we create a quiet and calm environment. Maximizing exposure to daylight, so don't let them sleep too much during the day. Try to keep them as awake as possible, because usually in the afternoons is when you start having your issues, and more so towards the night. Limiting naps and caffeine, and making sure that we consult with the healthcare provider if they need any different medication choices. Safety is going to be important, especially when we're educating family. Because they're going to start wandering off, so supervision is going to be needed. That's a major concern whenever Alzheimer's patients wander off. Pain management, we need to make sure that we're recognizing and treating it promptly. They usually start to act out if they're experiencing pain, so we need to know how to detect whenever they start experiencing pain, and then we could treat it accordingly. Undernutrition is a problem with these patients, especially with them having decreased ability to self-feed. So we need to make sure that we're taking time with them. They may need pureed foods, thickened foods, and also nutritional supplements. We need to remind them to chew and swallow, offer liquids frequently, and making sure that they're not being rushed and that they're in a quiet environment when they're eating. Infection prevention, because UTIs and pneumonia are going to be common in these patients, so making sure that they're dry and clean at all times, that they're wiping the correct way. We can do turn cough, deep breathing exercises, especially preventing so that they don't set up pneumonia. Skin care, they're going to be at risk for skin breakdown, especially if they become incontinent or immobile, and if they're under if their nutrition is not where it needs to be. So just being aware of those different things. And caregiver support, that's going to be very important, especially if their family is not used to having to deal with this condition. So making sure that we're being supportive and educating them and giving them the proper resources that they need to make sure that their loved one is cared for. And this is going to conclude the lecture.